Okay, so welcome back. So one of the theme we're having for the women's class for the foreseeable future is having talks about the Teres. So the Terigatha is an ancient text, which are the poems of the first Buddhist nuns. And all of the poems are written, I mean, obviously an oral tradition for a long time, by the women in the Buddha's time who became enlightened. So today I'm going to talk about a woman called Kisa Gotami. And the material I'm going to talk about is sort of taken from various talks and papers I've read. I'm no scholar, so it's not very academic, I'm afraid. But one of the main sources is from a few talks I heard given by women, I think mostly nuns, at a symposium organised by Nalio at Hamburg University. So it was all about women in Buddhism. And many of these scholars are looking at more and more very ancient texts and really sort of thinking about the texts that are most pertinent for women today, or what they can teach us about how we practice as Buddhists today. Because we all know that women today can, well, especially if we have safety and housing and choices, we can practice as Buddhists in a very different way to women even 100 years ago. So this story is called The Mustard Seed, and it's the story of Kisa Gotami. And this was Kisa Gotami was a very poor young woman who lived a very harsh life, and her family obviously, at that time, wanted her to get married. And finally she found a husband. She wasn't well respected in the family until she had a son. So unfortunately for her, the son gradually became sick and died. And Kisa Gotami just couldn't believe that he was dead. And she wandered around carrying him in her arms, hoping he'd come back to life. And what she did was she wandered through the village asking the people to give her medicine so that her son would be cured. And she came into contact with a lot of different responses. So many people scorned her, many people were bewildered, many people were embarrassed and confused about this young woman with a dead child in her arms arriving at the door asking for medicine. There were some people that could understand her grief and tried to reason with her and offer her consolation. So they tried to help her understand that the child was dead, because she couldn't even come to terms that the child was actually dead. But she just couldn't hear them and carried on wandering in an incredibly grief-stricken state. So there were some people that realised that the Buddha was close by and suggested that Kisa Gotami go to see the Buddha and that he'd be able to help her. And Kisa Goswami went to the Buddha and pleaded with him to give her medicine for her child. And he said, yes, I can help, but before I can help, you need to bring me a mustard seed from a family or household where no one has died. And so she then went to ask for this mustard seed, and people were more open to her. But once she said, well, it has to be from a household where no one has died, of course they couldn't give her the mustard seed. There was always somebody that had died within the big extended families that they all had. And in her wandering, she gradually came to realize that she wasn't alone in her grief, that she'd met lots and lots of people who were grieving around close family members who had died. So she returned to the Buddha, and before he could even say anything, she said, your request has done its work. So she came to understand the truth of death. And after that, she became a nun and wandered the forest and achieved enlightenment. So this is part of the poem. Lowly and destitute by birth, reborn a thousand times, she suffered untold sorrow. The tears her eyes shed were as boundless as the sea, born to a lot so humble, a target for scorn, that by the light of truth she won release. So Kisa Goswami was born into a very poor family, had a very harsh life. You can imagine the difficulty the family had to find her a husband. And as I said in the story, she was finally given respect when she gave birth to a son. So at that time, and for many, many cultures, even today, there's great value in giving birth to a son and raising a son. And so the question arises, you know, why not fathers and their children, the father-son connection, the father-daughter connection, the mother-daughter connection, why is that not seen as just as important? So why is it bad karma in the early scriptures to be born a woman? And many of the scholars point out that the earliest scriptures did not say that, and that the later scriptures took on the fact of discrimination in the culture. So women were always, and many are still, under the control of others. And there are all cultures where the male status is much higher than the female status. So the child became sick and died. Kisa Goswami refused to believe he was dead and clung to his body. So notice the word cling or clung. She wandered through the village asking for medicine to cure her son. So this motive of the grieving mother comes up again and again and again in Buddhist scriptures. And one of the reasons is that it was thought that a grieving mother is in such a state of suffering or even a state of madness from grief that she becomes spiritually stunted, and that it is very difficult to reach enlightenment from this state. So there are very old models of different realms of life where the human realm is the state where one can achieve enlightenment most readily, and then the hell realm where it's much harder, the animal realm where it's impossible, the hungry ghost realm where it's impossible. Have I said enough? And the God realm, where it is also impossible, because they're having such a nice time, they don't have the impetus to develop their practice. So you know, in some ways, I sort of try to understand why these scriptures have been written in this way. And there just was this genuine feeling that mothers would grieve so much that they, and you can imagine at that time in history and that time up to recent history, mothers would always be losing children and often dying themselves. So in some ways you can sort of see it as perhaps a little bit of compassion there for women. So the son, why is it always a baby son or an adult son? There are other stories that talk about a mother losing her adult son. Again, apart from all the cultural aspects of that, because sons would care for their mothers in their old age, it is also, you know, about life is pretty meaningless without a son. And if you look at the cultural accreditations on that, if you lose your son and have nothing else, your family, her family, in, you know, the inherent sort of subtext of the story is her family didn't stay around to help her in her grief. She was banished. And that society did not give her credit. So the whole, in a way, by losing her son, she lost absolutely everything. She lost any respect and any status that she ever achieved. And one of the, we know from the Four Noble Truths that we know that attachment leads to suffering. And so the mother's love for her child or her son is seen as attachment. And again, it's very difficult because we understand attachment as secure attachment, you know, where you feel safe to develop and blossom, or neurotic attachment, where you are very focused on someone or something, which inevitably cannot bring you happiness. So in the scriptures, this attachment is seen as the embodiment of the human state of suffering. So in a way, it's been otherized. And the scholars point out that very often when this state of grief is being explained, metaphors of animals are given. It's almost considered to be an animal state, which of course is very painful for us to hear that, isn't it? So she was treated with scorn, bewilderment, and confusion. Some tried to reason with her and offer her consolation. They tried to make her understand, but she could not listen. And she couldn't listen, she couldn't hear them because of this incredible state of grief. She had lost absolutely everything. And it's often occurred to me that what we do as human beings is when we see massive states of suffering, we try and make sense of them, we try and blame somebody or something for it, and we tend to otherize the person. So we see a person that is suffering, and when we can't cope with that suffering, we tend to then blame that person and make them other. We're not connected as human beings. And something that really brought this home to me was I was teaching a school group, mindfulness and meditation. And one of the teachers had asked about karma, so I was talking about karma. And one young boy blurted out, "Coming back as a woman is worse than coming back as a dog." And there was this massive gasp in the room.
Yes.
And the girls were just looking daggers at him. And you could see he sort of wished he hadn't said it. And I had to take a deep breath. But I did thank him for saying it, because it's better out than in. And as I was explaining that in traditional culture, coming back as a woman is seen as such bad karma, is because women suffered so much. And then that's when it really occurred to me how we otherize suffering. And I actually ended up back in the same school doing a multi-faith assembly. And there sort of weren't those attitudes arising. And, it was a school that had really taken on that they teach their pupils about all religions and, you know, really talk about attitudes that are unhelpful. So I quite admired them. But I walked into the school and thought, oh no! But hey, it was really good. It was really good. So because intense grief can drive somebody to madness, they lack the presence of mind essential for spiritual development. So in a way, that's why intense grieving is seen in these early scriptures as a product of being attached and then loss. So you can sort of see how it's arisen. So some suggested that Kisa Gotami find the Buddha, who was thought to have great powers. With renewed hope, she pleaded with him to give her medicine. And he said he could help, but she needed to find to be given a mustard seed from a household where nobody had died. And in a way, you can see how the Buddha has used this skillful means of helping Kisa Gotami come to the realization herself. And, you know, that's something we know about Buddhist practice, is we don't follow, you know, things we're told without really knowing them to be true, and that we're all on our different paths, in a way, sort of finding more out about ourselves, because of our practice, we make more connection with the world, we become more compassionate, we develop. And the Buddha has often said, "Don't believe me, find the truth out for yourself." And so as she came to realize, as she wandered about, that all these households had experienced intense grief. She came to see the universality of suffering and the universality of grief, and therefore the universal understanding of the truth of impermanence. So when she returned to the Buddha, she told him the request had done its work, and she became a nun, wandered the forest, and achieved enlightenment. And so it brings, well, how does this dramatic transformation take place? And what it is like, you know, what we try and do in the practice of the Metta Bhavana is that we take particular emotions and come to a universal understanding. So we use our own emotional state and we extend the understanding outwards. Now, the scholars are all finding that according to many Buddhist scriptures, it's this complete understanding of impermanence and therefore enlightenment is made possible by severing the mother-child bond. And that suggests the incompatibility of the state of motherhood with enlightenment. This love is thought to be selfish because it's bound to samsara, it's bound to the everyday world, and therefore it's been condemned. So anyone here that is a mother, that wants to become a mother, sort of knows that if you're practicing mindfulness and metta, if you're developing spiritually, you know that your love isn't so focused, that it does easily transform to be more universal. So Rita Gross is a very important American Buddhist feminist, and she even suggests that as modern women, we forget about gender, we forget about the gender of the stories we're reading, and just find the stories and the accounts that we find helpful to our own practice. Because scholars are finding loads and loads of scriptures that suggest different ways of practicing, different aspects of being human. She's also, and many other scholars, have looked at the stories from the folklore of the times. And a lot of research has been put into that, because it's thought that generally women found folk stories much more accessible, and of course there were loads and loads and loads of Buddhist folk stories that weren't 500 years later transcribed by monks and become the sutras that we read today. And I'll tell you one sort of towards the end of the talk. And, you know, feminist scholars, of course, are asking the questions, you know, why are the nuns in the Terigatha a product of demasculination, that they have to leave everything that they were doing as women and wander and practice like the men, and wonder why the love of their children was never seen as expansive. So there is a danger of taking symbolism in the sutras very literally. And of course there is truth in the exclusivity of mother-children bonds. Because a tendency is to, of course, put one's children first. But as practicing Buddhists, you know, one would hope that we wouldn't be doing that, that we wouldn't need to do that. We see a much bigger picture. Many people who aren't Buddhists see the bigger picture, but many people are also very, very focused on their children. So many of you might have heard of the Karuna Metta Sutra. And actually, the interesting thing is the scholars say that, you know, where it talks about you have compassion as expansive and as strong as the mother has for her only child, they use love, so you love as strongly as the mother's love for her only child. And many scholars suggest that the word protection might be a better word, because it doesn't have the connotations of love as being around about attachment in the sutras. It depends a lot how we understand love. And of course, there's many, many different understandings of it. So we can develop dispassion, where the self doesn't come first, and develop love that is detached and equanimous. So I'll tell you the story that I heard on one of the talks, the Hamburg talks. So it's about Yakshmi, a female demon. And she's very, very cruel. And what she does is she devours human children. She also has 500 sons. And she has one favourite. Unfortunately, the favourite son dies and she is absolutely distraught. And she goes to the Buddha for help in her grief. And what the Buddha does is he reminds her, or helps her understand, that the human beings around the sons that she devoured are experiencing the same sort of grief that she is experiencing for the death of her favourite son. And then he asks, so why do you devour the children of others? And of course she realises, as people do in the sutras very quickly, that the love needs to be universal, and she stops eating human children. And what happens is the Buddha suggests that if the monks offer her food, she will then protect the monastery, and she will also help childless couples conceive, because she understands the need at that time to have children and to particularly have sons. The reason she was eating human children was so she could feed her 499 sons. So what the monks do is they offer her food. And so traditionally she's become the benevolent and protective goddess who brings out mothering in monks and helps families. So these origins are in the South Asian folk tradition, and they show a greater accommodation of motherhood. Unfortunately, she has to be a demon. So, but it is interesting that many of the big relief organisations, for example, Buddhist Compassionate Relief in Taiwan, they've been started by nuns. There's particular Thai traditions
where nuns value motherhood and help lead women to higher levels of spiritual development. Some of those women later become nuns, but they still have that nurturing quality. And so mother love is then seen as world love. There's a story of Deepa Ma, who describes the care of children as being meditative practice and therefore important to spiritual development. And the scholars of the early sutras suggest that being a woman is an obstruction because of the way society is constructed or was constructed at that time. But not, so being a woman is difficult in society, but is not difficult to practice and follow the Buddhist path. So as I said earlier, you know, the feminist perspective is to find sutras that are helpful. And traditionally, there's sort of a succession of roles of men to lead them to enlightenment, which is attributed to being male. And in a way, what's happened is we haven't received the teachings where the succession towards enlightenment is attributed to females. So we have a patriarchal model of Buddhism, basically, which are, as I've said many times in this talk, they are being challenged by a lot of scholars. So that's the story and some of the meaning underlying the story. I guess it's important, whatever we read, we wonder whether that has relevance for ourselves. It's not saying everyone should be mothers, but all aspects of women be valued. I'm happy to sort of answer or have a discussion of anything that might have occurred to you. So thank you.
Thank you.